From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Political drama intensifies on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. Director James Comey told Congress today the FBI is investigating claims that the Trump campaign coordinated with Russia. And he firmly denied the president's accusation that Barack Obama wiretapped him before the election.
I have no information that supports those tweets.
For their part, Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee pressed hard on finding the sources of intelligence leaks to the news media. We'll hear some of today's give and take and some commentary on what it could mean for both Republicans and Democrats. On today's Talking Point later, President Trump resets relations with Saudi Arabia. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The directors of the FBI and the NSA testified on Capitol Hill today there is no evidence for President Trump's claim he was wiretapped by former President Obama. We heard about that and the investigation into Russian tampering with last year's presidential campaign. Later on today's Talking Point, Saudi Arabia is in the midst of a generational change and the Deputy Crown Prince, a rising power, got a handshake last week from President Trump. Both countries say relations are improving. First is news update. Republicans in the Senate never allowed a vote on President Obama's appointment of Judge Merrick Garland to the U.S. Supreme Court. Democrats have not forgotten. That was clear today as the Judiciary Committee took up President Trump's nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch. Here's California's Dianne Feinstein.
President Trump repeatedly promised to appoint someone in the mold of Justice Scalia, and said that the nomination of Judge Gorsuch illustrates he's a man of his word. For those of us on this side, our job is not to theoretically evaluate this or that legal doctrine or to review Judge Gorsuch's record in a vacuum. Our job is to determine whether Judge Gorsuch is a reasonable mainstream conservative.
Mark Joseph Stern is legal affairs reporter for Slate. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me back on.
Our job is to determine whether Gorsuch is a mainstream conservative. Those aren't exactly fighting words.
No, and I'm not actually sure what they mean. Feinstein kicked off the morning from the Democratic side. I thought she did a pretty terrible job. You know, she's not the Democrat best suited for this particular duty. She sort of meandered and did not find a real thesis. She mentioned Merrick Garland. She mentioned the blockade. But when she turned to the merits of Gorsuch himself, she didn't seem to have a clear idea of why she opposed him. It was clear she doesn't really like him. It was clear that there are some decisions that she doesn't agree with, but she failed to really land a punch that explained why she has decided to take this adversarial stance. And so I think it was a really weak start to the morning for the Democratic side, and I'm not sure it got much better after that.
Well, here she is, the leading Republican on that, the leading Democrat on that committee. Does this suggest that the party really doesn't have a strategy? They don't have the votes in the Senate to stop him, do they?
No, they don't. You know, there are certainly 52 votes for Gorsuch. Every Republican is on board. There may be a few moderate Democrats, Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, for instance, who join that, and maybe even enough to overcome a filibuster. That would, of course, require 60 votes. So the fight here is really around the margins. It's about scoring political points. It's about expressing disgust over what Republicans did to Garland. And it's about laying the seeds, planting the seeds for future attacks on Gorsuch and rulings that he might join or author at the Supreme Court. But even by those standards, I'm just not clear on what Democrats are doing today. They haven't formed a sort of cohesive attack yet. They haven't come together and settled on one particular area, reproductive rights, LGBT rights, that they think they can absolutely win on. There's been a lot of talk about Gorsuch siding with the big guy against the little guy, but that's really abstract, and I don't even think it's a particularly fair line of attack. So it seems like in all of their goals, they're floundering, and they don't have much time today left to recover.
What about the Republicans? What is their main objective if they see Gorsuch as a certain nominee? Are they that the court won't have changed much since the death of Antonin Scalia?
That's right. The Republicans are just beaming today. I mean, they all look extraordinarily happy, and they have every reason to be. If Judge Garland had been appointed and confirmed to this position, the court would have swung moderately to the left. But instead, Gorsuch will continue Scalia's legacy in almost certainly every area of the law, barring maybe a few minor deviations. And so this will maintain the status quo of where the court was before Justice Scalia died, which was outside of a few big rulings on fair housing and, of course, marriage equality, a pretty conservative court.
So what about the pressure that the Democrats are getting from the left in their party, which is to oppose Gorsuch down to the last possible vote? They don't seem willing to do that.
No, they don't. And I think that that strategy by the grassroots left-wing activists could prove to be pretty self-destructive for the Democratic Party. You don't see these guys gathering enough fodder yet to have a really principled anti-Gorsuch stance. And it does look from this early point like a lot of them may wind up voting yes, or at least a handful. That will enrage liberal activists. That will make them want to primary these people, campaign against them. It will turn their attention away from who is the real enemy for their agenda, which is, of course, Republicans and Trump. And it will push the party back into a kind of civil war, which the party definitely does not need right now.
And Democrats in red states, those won by Donald Trump, who are up for reelection, certainly are going to feel the most pressure of all.
Yes, that's right. They understand that they're going to need some Republican votes probably to stay in office. They don't want to be campaigned against as the person who voted against this eminently qualified and a mainstream conservative judge. And so I think there is a lot of pressure on them from moderate Republicans to just go ahead and cast a yes vote.
Okay. Mark Joseph Stern with Slate. Great to talk with you as always. And thanks again.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
In a moment, even more political drama on Capitol Hill on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. FBI Director James Comey has confirmed publicly for the first time there is an investigation of Russia's alleged efforts to influence last year's presidential campaign. In his opening statement to the House Intelligence Committee, he went even further.
That includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts.
Eric Geller covers cybersecurity for Political Pro. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is pretty long. This is a pretty revealing statement, it seems to me, by the FBI director. And he said he was asked to give this information to the committee, be public about it, by the Justice Department. That means the Attorney General.
Well, in this case, it means that the acting deputy attorney general,
Jeff
Sessions, has recused himself.
Okay.
But certainly it's very important that the Justice Department is essentially giving Director Comey permission to weigh in here. It suggests that they think they need to sort of clear the air here.
Thank you for pointing out that Sessions has recused himself. That's a very important part of this. But what about the information that was revealed by both the FBI director and the director of the NSA?
Well, essentially what they have said here today is, first of all, I should note they're being very careful not to discuss the ongoing investigations. Director Comey essentially said, I can confirm that we are investigating. I cannot confirm any details. It was really interesting to watch essentially a string of, you know, maybe around a dozen lawmakers asking him for details. Would it be criminal if this happened? Or are you looking into this individual, for example, Carter Page, Paul Manafort, people associated with President Trump's campaign? And he would not comment on any of it. He just, you know, was essentially a brick wall because he wants to preserve the integrity of the investigation. He does not want to overstep the procedures that he sets out for conducting these investigations.
What about the Republicans?
Well, the Republicans took a different tack. So the Democrats mostly focused on asking those kinds of questions, the substance of the investigation. Republicans focused more on the leaks that led to all the questions that we're hearing right now. So several of them asked, for example, who in the FBI and for Admiral Rogers, who at the NSA would have access to the unminimized, which is to say sort of unredacted audio intercepts of intercepts from Russian officials speaking to potentially Trump associates. And the point there, I think, seemed to be who are the people who could have leaked this? Who are the people who had access to the information? So they very much focused on that part of the story.
Okay. Admiral Mike Rogers, of course, is the head of the NSA. Here is the ranking Democrat, Adam Schiff from California, pressing the FBI director, Mr. Comey, on the motive for the Russians meddling in the election.
It wasn't simply that the Russians had a negative preference against Secretary Clinton. They also had a positive preference for Donald Trump. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
I'm not going to put you in the spot of answering whether this is an accurate characterization of Mr. Trump's views, but it would be logical for the Kremlin to want someone who had a dim view of NATO. Is that right?
All kidding aside, I don't think that's something I should be answering. I mean, that's beyond my responsibilities.
Well, what is the Russian view of NATO? Do they like NATO? Do they want to see NATO strong?
Well, again, I'm sure you have already spoken to people who are greater experts than I, but yeah, they don't like NATO. They think NATO encircles them and threatens them.
David Korn is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. He joins us from outside the House Intelligence Committee hearing. He was there today. And David, always good to have you on our show.
Good to be with you, Warren.
What did we learn today that we didn't learn before?
Well, we learned a couple of really big things. I think this is one of the most consequential congressional hearings I've been at in a long time. To begin with, Director Comey said for the first time publicly that there has been an investigation, it's still ongoing, being conducted by the FBI, of contacts between Trump associates and Russia, or Russians, or agents of the government. He has never said this publicly. He said he had to get the approval of the Justice Department to make this statement, meaning that I assume if the Deputy Attorney General, not the Attorney General, since he recused himself, had to sign off on this. This is highly irrelevant and significant because Comey said this investigation began in late July. That means throughout the campaign, the FBI was investigating members of Trump's circle to some degree. We don't know the details. We don't know who he focused in on about their contact, their ongoing contact with Russia, while Russia was mounting an operation against the United States, and Donald Trump was doing everything he can to encourage that operation and to praise Putin and Russia while this was going.
What about the statement that the president has made so many times that President Obama, in fact, put a wiretap on him in Trump Tower?
Well, Comey and Mike Rogers, who's the head of NSA, completely blew that out of the water. They said time and time again they have no evidence that supports that. They wouldn't say that the president was lying, but it was as close as you can get in this circumstance. You know, we all know that this was an absurd tweet, and they said yet again they have no evidence. The president also tweeted this morning that the whole Russia story is fake news created by the Democrats. Well, again, Comey and Rogers said that the intelligence community's assessment that there was an operation by Putin, he oversaw it or orchestrated or triggered it, to undermine the U.S. election to help Donald Trump. That assessment still stands, and they're still investigating further the Russian hacking. So I think today is a very puts the president in a really bad position. What he says about Obama wiretapping him, what he has said about the Russian hacking story, are just not true. It's false. That's the fake news here, and I don't know how he's going to respond to this hearing with other tweets.
Well, he has already tweeted today, as you have pointed out in your article, saying that that he heard fake news CNN doing polls again, and how way off they are and have been so long, much higher ratings at Fox. He said the real story that Congress, the FBI, and all the others must be looking into is the leaking of classified information. He's hitting that same point that the Republicans apparently did at the committee as well.
It was amazing. The hearing probably will end in the next hour or two, but so far the Republicans have focused almost exclusively on the issue of leaks. They have not talked at all about what Moscow and Putin did to attack and hack this campaign and what they're going to be doing in other countries and what they may do again in 2020. They just keep focusing on who leaked and why, and they're portraying Michael Flynn as a private citizen who's been victimized by leaks. Now, that may or may not be an issue, but they are completely saying nothing about the Russian attack on U.S. elections and U.S. democracy. I think this is, you know, a pretty low day for Republicans. I see why they're doing it, because to say anything else would be to embarrass Donald Trump.
David Korn again, a Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. His new book is Insane Clown President. Matt Taibbi, good to have you with us.
How's it going, Warren?
Good, thank you. No indication suggested by your title that you're necessarily on Donald Trump's side, but you have written that the Russia story, and this is the headline in Rolling Stone magazine, is a minefield for both Democrats and the media, and you have warned about a backlash against both the Democratic Party and the mainstream news media as well. What do you mean?
Well, I think this is a very – it's a highly complex story that has a lot of angles to it, and there are dangers. For instance, just to take one small example, but today in his opening statement, Congressman Schiff from California quoted the dossier prepared by former British intelligence agent Christopher Steele, and he – quoted it as though it was an authority and didn't suggest that it had been called into question or that any parts of it were unverified. So there's a political danger there if any part of that dossier comes up false or there are holes in the story, and we all know some of the outlandish claims that are in that dossier. Well, that could back up politically on the Democrats. I spent a lot of time in the last couple of weeks in the Senate listening to the Democrats give speeches about Russia. And because of there are so many unknowns in the story, they were continually forced into the position of saying, we don't know all the facts, but what we may discover is blackmail, betrayal, treason, things like this, and there's a temptation to be over their skis rhetorically, which I just worry will back up on both the press and the Democrats.
Who actually used the term treason?
I can't remember. I mean, I watched 30 hours of continuous debate before the Pruitt hearing. So, but you know the. Over and over again, especially the term blackmail, that came up again today. You know, it's concerning, and it's especially concerning because the one thing that can save Donald Trump politically right now is any kind of validation of his core accusation of media overreach and establishment bias against him, and that's what I worry about with this story.
So, David Korn, what do you say to that? Again, bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine.
I think in the grand scheme of things, and I like Matt, that's about 2% of what we should be worrying about or caring about. The fact that Moscow attacked political figures here to try to win an election their way is the paramount issue. There's nothing more important in this set of issues. And we need there to be a thorough investigation. Republicans are dragging their heels. They didn't want to do it. The fellow who benefited from this, Donald Trump, keeps lying about aspects of this and calling it fake news. And so if Democrats are getting over-eager and over-enthusiastic or stating things that may not be proven yet, well, tell me a political issue in which that never happens or doesn't happen. So I think that's looking at the wrong end of the telescope. I think this hearing today showing that the FBI has been investigating Trump camp since July is significant. Investigating the Russian hacking is significant. And I will point out, because this is the point that Trump makes, that there's, you know, he said that Clapper said the other week, there's no evidence of collusion between the Trump camp and Moscow. Well, the investigation is not over, but more importantly, there doesn't have to be direct collusion. From last June onward, there were media reports that Russia was behind this hacking. In mid-August, the Trump campaign was briefed that Russia was the culprit, and it was being done purposefully. So the question I have, Michael Flynn and other Trump people meeting with Russians during the campaign, if they were saying things like, you'll get a better deal with us than you wanted the Clinton administration, that is encouraging. That is encouraging someone who is committing an act of political warfare against the United States. That's what we need to find out, because that's almost as bad as direct coordination. If they were trying to take advantage of this, or telling the Russians, or giving the Russians and Putin incentives for waging that clandestine operation.
Let's hear a bit more of what happened on the in the hearing today. And here is Trey Gowdy. He is a Republican from South Carolina, former prosecutor like Adam Schiff of California, the Democrat. He's pressing FBI Director Comey on whether the Obama administration staff members might have been the source of leaks.
Would former Attorney General Loretta Lynch have access to an unmasked U.S. citizen's name?
In general, yes, as would any attorney general.
So that would also include acting AG Sally Yates?
Same answer.
Did you brief President Obama on, well, I'll just ask you. Did you brief President Obama on any calls involving Michael Flynn?
I'm not going to get into either that particular case, that matter, or any conversations I had with the president. So I can't answer that.
Matt Taibbi, back to you with the Rolling Stone magazine. Does that suggest that the Republicans might have something that they can use against the Democrats?
Well, it's a question of whether or not the public cares about it. But, you know, Gowdy continually during this hearing pressed, particularly Director Comey, on the question of whether or not leaks of the kind of information that appeared in the newspaper about General Flynn, whether they were crimes and whether such crimes needed to be investigated. He posed a hypothetical that Comey answered, stressing that he wasn't talking about anybody in particular, but he talked about how he would go about investigating the disclosure of a leak like that, which to me seemed like Gowdy actually kind of scored a point there, because he was in a way getting Comey to concede that this was an issue serious enough to warrant looking into. The question is whether anybody is going to really care about, you know, the leaking over the probably more serious matter of whether or not there was collusion between the Trump government and the Putin government.
David Corn, I know you need to leave us before we go to a break, which we're about to do in just a couple of minutes. So final word from you. What about the leak issue? To what extent might the Republicans be able to use that against the Democrats, particularly if there's no evidence that finally turns up showing that there was collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign?
Well, as I said, there doesn't have to be evidence of direct collusion. We need to know what signals the Trump camp is sending to Moscow, to Mike Flynn and others who were meeting with Russians before the election, and whether that was encouraging the Russians to hack the election. On the leak business, I think this is really weak beer. This is a diversion on their part, on Donald Trump's part, to say that's a real story. Leaking a story on the National Security Advisor lying to the vice president about talking to the Russians versus whether Moscow tried to subvert the election. That's what they're putting up against this, I think, historic scandal. It's just, you know, it's all they can talk about. And so I don't think it's going to get that far.
David Corn with Mother Jones, and many thanks to you. We'll be back in a moment with Eric Geller, with Matt Taibbi, and also Ali Watkins of BuzzFeed News. On our talking point later, President Trump resets relations with Saudi Arabia. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To the Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life. Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, talking about the House Intelligence Committee hearing today, at which the directors of both the FBI and the NSA testified that Donald Trump, President Trump, that there was no evidence for what he had said about the wiretapping by President Obama of him, Donald Trump, during the campaign last year. They also talked a lot, of course, about the Russian meddling in the campaign and revealed that there is, in fact, an investigation of that going on and whether there might have been collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign. Here again is Trey Gowdy. He once again is the Republican from South Carolina, former prosecutor, who says that the leaks may be worse somehow than the Russian meddling.
Some of it does not rise to the level of crime. One thing you and I agree on is the felonious dissemination of classified material most definitely is a crime. So I would ask you, and I understand some of the procedures that you are up against, I would humbly ask you to seek authority from whomever you need to seek authority from.
No response to that one. Ollie Watkins is national security correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've looked at some length into the issues involved, particularly with regard to the Russians. Tell us more than we've heard so far about what is suspected and what we know now that we didn't know before this hearing began.
I mean, I think that it's fair to say this hearing has given us more news than we expected. I don't think many of us were expecting Comey to publicly confirm that not only was there an open FBI investigation, but that FBI investigation includes looking at possible CI counterintelligence links between Trump's campaign team, Trump associates in Moscow. So that's kind of our new normal, that we have a public acknowledgement from the FBI director on that. You know, as far as the most interesting thing to me that came out of Comey so far in this hearing, which is a marathon at this point and still going, is this question of collusion. And, you know, obviously we have these two running investigations on the House Intelligence Committee having their hearing, and there's the Senate Intelligence Committee. And this running question has been, is there evidence of clear collusion between Trump campaign associates and Moscow? And the question that's come up with a lot of my intelligence sources who are either familiar with these investigations or familiar with the greater FBI probes is, does collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow have to be conscious? For example, does a Trump affiliate have to know that they're talking to a Russian intelligence operative? And Comey, I mean, the running assumption from intelligence officials was that collusion had to be conscious, that, you know, someone couldn't be talking to a Russian oligarch and feign ignorance, that someone could have been talking to someone and not know that they were actually colluding with anyone. But Comey made a really interesting comment earlier in the hearing about how you could, in fact, knowingly collude and knowingly be a counterintelligence threat without knowing that you're doing it, essentially unconsciously colluding with foreign intelligence operatives, which kind of changes the game as to how we look at this potential Trump campaign-Russia connection. That really changes the footing of both of these investigations moving forward.
Would you have to be ignorant then of the fact that the Russian you were talking to was in fact an intelligence agent or intelligence gatherer in order to be unconscious of your collusion?
That's essentially what Comey was saying. And part of this comes with, as Matt Taibbi mentioned, just knowing what the secret world is like in Russia. I mean, it's not like the U.S. The lines between, you know, an oligarch and the intelligence services is incredibly small and gray, and there's a lot of, you know, back and forth. So, you know, in theory, a Trump campaign affiliate could easily be talking to an oligarch or a businessman in a business context, but that businessman could also have ties to Russian intelligence. So from the way Comey said it is that, yes, that conversation could have been happening strictly on a business professional level, but if you are having that conversation with someone, even if you don't know they're an intelligence operative, then you are colluding with a foreign power. And that really changes the landscape, I think, here.
Let me go back to Eric Geller, our first guest, to cover cybersecurity for Political Pro. The name of Roger Stone, longtime confidant of Donald Trump, came up a lot during these hearings. He has in the past. Why do we hear his name?
Well, we're hearing his name because he has admitted to contact with two of the, I suppose you could say, entities that were at the center of that leak, the hack and leak firestorm last year. So one of them is WikiLeaks. He has acknowledged that he has had contact, I believe he said through an intermediary, with Julian Assange, who runs WikiLeaks. And of course, he famously tweeted out that, I don't remember the exact phrasing, but he essentially tweeted out that the Clinton campaign's time had come, and then that was, I believe, a few weeks before the Podesta leaks began, his email leaks. He essentially directly said, you know, something was coming soon for Podesta, and then those email leaks began. So that's the first part. The second part is that he admitted to having contacts through Twitter, the direct messaging feature on Twitter, with an account that is essentially believed to be a cutout for Russian intelligence. So it's a Twitter account claiming to be a hacker, but the intelligence community believes this account has been used to essentially launder a lot of these stolen documents. Some of these documents include state house races from the Democrats' House campaign arm. There's also a list of all the Democratic lawmakers' addresses and phone numbers. That was a particularly sensitive leak. And so this Twitter account, Mr. Stone has said, yes, I talked to this person. I don't necessarily believe that they're associated with Russian intelligence. That was a particularly eyebrow-raising claim, as he said. He didn't see any reason to think that they were part of this hack and leak campaign, and he portrays these contacts as innocent.
Let me go back to Matt Taibbi, the contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, who's written Why the Russian Story is a Minefield for Democrats and the Media. Don't we all have to concede that every government tries to mess in the elections of other governments? We've had that confirmed on our program by none other than Richard Clark, who used to be head of intelligence or was one of the major intelligence advisors for George W. Bush and presidents prior to him as well. So the real issue is whether there was collusion with the Trump campaign, it would seem to me. And I gather that your point is that if that isn't proven, then both the Democrats and the media, and it's important to mention the media, I think, loudly in this context, particularly given what we've heard today and at other times from President Trump, that this could be very dangerous and could, in fact, backfire in an important way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, of course, Russia is not the only country to meddle in the affairs of a foreign state. I mean, I was in Russia in 1996 when we more or less openly meddled in the Boris Yeltsin's re-election. If you look back at Time magazine in July of 1996, there's a cover that says "Yanks to the Rescue," and it's all about how we sent advisors over to help him win. And but you know, look, the issue here is that this is sort of an order of magnitude more serious. The idea of a foreign country hacking the database of a political party and then releasing potentially that information to try to influence an election, that is, if true, it's a historically serious act, and everybody should absolutely be very, very concerned about it, and especially for the potential of that to happen in the future. The problem is there's an order of magnitude difference between that happening and that happening in addition to the Trump campaign being in on it. What I worry about is that we're not always making that distinction. Yes, both things would be incredibly serious, but we haven't seen actual evidence of the second thing yet. And if that turns out not to be the case, and it could be the case, but if it turns out not to be the case, then there are going to be a lot of people who are going to have to listen to Donald Trump complaining about it for the next 4 years.
Now, let me go back to Ollie Watkins again with BuzzFeed News. You've talked to a lot of people who are working on this in the Senate. Are they concerned about the politicization of these issues that are going on in the House?
Absolutely. And to Matt's point, I think there's a real concern from intelligence officials across the board that there is kind of a missing the forest for the trees kind of phenomenon going on with the Russia question. You have these kind of two dueling narratives. You have the known fact, the widely agreed upon fact, that Russia worked actively to undermine and manipulate the election, and that the subsequent narrative that is, not only did they do it, they did it with coordination with the Trump campaign. So I think there is a real concern that from the Senate's perspective, you have obviously the Senate and the House perspective. Senate has been far quieter on their investigation than the House has. They have not had active public hearings or public press conferences like Chairman Schiff and Nunes have. And I think there is kind of this black and white perspective of it right now, fueled certainly by the media and Democrats too sometimes, I think, of that either Russia worked to manipulate the election and they did it with the help of Trump, so it's a big deal, or Trump didn't know, so it's not a big deal. And there's no recognition that there's this middle ground of like, no, the fact that a foreign power worked to manipulate the election is in and of itself a huge deal. So I think there's a real concern. And, you know, from people that I've been talking to that are kept abreast of these investigations, there is a real, I think there's kind of been a sobering in the last 2 or 3 weeks of, you know, have Democrats kind of dug themselves a hole here in kind of pushing this connection between Trump and Russia narrative, then have you suddenly inflated expectations and essentially changed the entire focus? So you're missing the bigger picture of the just general Russia op sans any kind of Trump coordination. So there's, I think there's absolutely a concern that the expectations have been so inflated that there's going to be this silver bullet connecting the Trump campaign and Russia, that there is a real, I think, concrete concern that there's going that the actual known threat of Russia working to manipulate Western elections is going to go kind of disregarded.
Eric Geller, back to you with a political pro. There's a lot of investigating going on. Does the Senate have more resources to do this than the House? Are they both relying on the FBI and the NSA? Do they these investigations all overlap, or are some of them going in different directions?
Well, certainly they are overlapping. The leaders of the Senate and House committees have put out statements essentially saying, we have agreed that this is the scope of our inquiry, and they are essentially overlapping. They say they're going to focus on what Russia did, whether there was any connection between Russia and campaigns, and then, of course, how all the information that we know about this situation came to be leaked. So those are kind of the portfolios. I would say that, you know, Ali probably can speak better to whether the Senate or the House has more resources. I would imagine that in both cases, it's not as many as they need. I mean, certainly today at the House hearing, Adam Schiff, the top Democrat, said to Director Comey, we are working with a very small staff. We don't have the resources that you have, and so we're going to need your help. And I think that goes to the other question that you mentioned, which is, are they relying on the FBI and the NSA? Absolutely they are. They need to go to the FBI's facilities, the NSA's facilities, have documents brought to them in their committee hearing rooms, and they need to be able to review in secure rooms all the intelligence product that has been gathered, that has been compiled. They need to look at the primary source material. And so, you know, the extent to which the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA cooperate, what they're willing to show them, that's going to be hugely important. Certainly, Ali and others have reported that the Gang of Eight, the so-called eight senior-most figures in the intelligence world, so the leaders of both parties and then the leaders in both parties of both of these committees, those eight people, typically they get the most sensitive information, and a lot of that is restricted to just them. In this case, I believe it's the case for both the House and the Senate. The full committees are being brought in to that level of information in terms of the material that the FBI and the intelligence community have. So that's unprecedented, and I think a reflection of the intelligence community's desire to cooperate and really do as much as they can, or at least to be seen doing as much as they can to help the congressional investigators.
And we'll have to watch and see how much leaking there is as a result of so many people being involved in all of this. Matt Taibbi, back to you. What about the other part of this, that the FBI and the NSA both denied in very strong terms today that they had any evidence whatsoever of President Trump's assertion that he was spied on by former President Obama. What does that tell us about the truthfulness of our chief executive? How do we now assess what the White House says about anything?
Well, I don't think I'm the only person who would say that we didn't learn anything about the truthfulness of Donald Trump that we probably didn't know already years ago. But certainly, this is a new kind of administration that where public statements are not carefully vetted by groups of people. There isn't a team of White House officers that sits down together and decides what the White House is going to release. We have an individual who may or may not just be sitting at his phone tweeting at all hours of the day, and it may be about whether or not Barack Obama wiretapped the Trump Tower, and it might be about Meryl Streep's speech at the Golden Globes, but there doesn't appear to be any filter between Donald Trump and his public statements, which is extremely concerning and disturbing, and it speaks to an enormous galaxy of potential problems going forward, especially when you consider what might happen, for instance, on the foreign policy front if he starts saying things about other countries. So, yeah, it's very concerning.
Ali Watkins, quickly, with all the people that you've talked to about this, particularly on the Senate side, are the Republicans very concerned about what we just heard described and what we've heard described for so many days now?
You know, I think, like, there's so many different camps of Republicans on this issue right now. A lot of the ones that I've talked to are involved in the national security realm. And I will say, I think there's been, you kind of have Republican leadership leading a lot of the narrative in Congress right now. But I think when you get down to national security-minded representatives, there has been a running recognition of just how serious this situation is. I think the only real difference, and that is a very bipartisan concern, I think the real difference has been Republicans may not have taken the Trump potential Trump links as seriously as Democrats did, but that also comes with its balance, as Matt has spoken so well to. So I think as far as how Republicans are going to respond to this, I think on the Senate side, the Senate investigation is going to continue to do what it's doing, keep its head down, keep kind of running their own investigation. Republicans who have shown to be more partisan about the issue are going to continue to be more partisan about the issue. I mean, we've already seen from just earlier today when Comey said that they had not seen evidence of vote tallies being manipulated. We've seen that turn into Twitter fodder already from the right of, you sure. know, no evidence Russia influenced the election. So it's going to be played the way that I think it's expected to be played. But under the politics, I do think that there's a cohort of Republicans who take this seriously.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for being with us. Ali Watkins, national security correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Matt Taibbi, contributor to Rolling Stone, his new book, Insane Clown President. Next to Eric Geller with Politico Pro, and David Korn, our earlier guest for the first half of our program, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. We're going to be hearing a lot more about all of this, of course, in days to come. In a moment, President Trump and warming relations with America's oldest ally in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia. Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're on here with today's talking point. President Trump did not shake hands with German Chancellor Angela Merkel last week, at least in front of reporters in the Oval Office. But he did provide that courtesy to another visitor, Saudi Arabia's 30-year-old Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Afterwards, the Saudis called the meeting a historic turning point, and they supported President Trump's travel ban. Bruce Rydell is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He directs the intelligence project there. And thanks a lot for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Were the Saudis happy to see the last of the Obama administration?
The Saudis were very happy to see the end of the Obama administration, which is kind of ironic in many ways. No president has courted the Saudis more than Barack Obama did. He traveled there more than any other country in the Middle East, more than he traveled to Israel. And he sold the Saudis over $110 billion worth of arms, which, again, is a staggering amount of money, and no other president comes close. But he also flirted with supporting democracy and political reform during the Arab Spring in 2011. And from the Saudi standpoint, that made him a very unreliable ally and one that they were happy to see the end of. They don't want this conversation with America to be about political reform, democracy, gender equality, and issues like that. they want it to be all about Iran and terrorism and issues like those. So seeing the end of Barack Obama was for them a relief.
I take it particularly they don't want to hear about human rights.
No, Saudi Arabia has an abysmal human rights record. It is the only country in the world where women can't drive, and it is got a peculiar form of Islam, which is particularly intolerant. It's not an issue the Saudis want to talk about, and I think the Trump administration has sent them every signal. Don't worry, it's not going to come up for at least the next 4 years.
Tell us a little bit more about the Deputy Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman.
Mohammed bin Salman is Saudi-educated, which is unusual in the kingdom. Most princes of his type would have probably had some Western education. He hasn't had any. He's the king's favorite son. He has older brothers, one of whom, for example, was Saudi Arabia's first astronaut. But the king clearly feels that Mohammed bin Salman is the favorite of his brood, and he has given him, in the last 2 years, since the king ascended to the throne, an unbelievable amount of power in the kingdom. He runs the military. He's the Minister of Defense. He's also in charge of the economy. This much power in the hands of a 30-year-old is unprecedented in the modern history of Saudi Arabia.
We see so many of the, or have seen over the years, so many of the leaders really into their 70s and 80s sometimes. An older generation has been in charge. So this is really something extraordinarily new.
That's right. Saudi Arabia is moving into uncharted grounds. For the last 60 years, power has gone in a line of succession among brothers, all of whom were sons of the founder of the modern kingdom, Ibn Saud. When he died in 1953, his eldest son succeeded him, and King Salman will be the last of those sons to ascend to the throne. So power is being passed to a new generation. It's something that Saudis have not seen in modern history, and it's going to raise real questions about legitimacy that we haven't heard in Saudi Arabia basically in the last half century or more.
Has he had much to do as head of the military, I assume he must have, with what's going on in Yemen?
Prince Mohammed bin Salman is the architect of the Yemen war. He was the one who, more than any other, pressed for it. And in the early months of the war, he was the face of the war on Saudi television and in Saudi media. As the war became increasingly a stalemate, he's tried to remove his face from being that of the face of the war and to make the argument that it was all a collective decision, trying to make sure that all the blame for what's going on there doesn't resolve solely upon himself. But a lot of the blame is put on Mohammed bin Salman, and you hear increasing mutterings by Saudis about, when is this war ever going to end?
Tell us more about the war itself, what the Saudis hope to achieve, and why you refer to it as a stalemate.
The Saudis intervened after a rebel group called the Houthis overthrew the democratically elected government of Prime Minister Hadi about 2 years ago. The Houthis are close to the Iranians. They're not Iranian puppets, but they do enjoy Iranian support. And what the Saudis were fearful was that Iran was about to set up a puppet in the southwest corner of the Arabian Peninsula, kind of the soft underbelly of Saudi Arabia. So they've intervened, but Saudi Arabia is very reluctant to put its ground troops into the war. So most of Saudi Arabia's role in this war has been air power, and the Saudis have been bombing Yemeni cities. They've also cut off Yemen from the outside world with a naval blockade and an air blockade, and that is producing a terrible humanitarian catastrophe. Something like 7 million Yemeni children are now facing serious malnutrition. A Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from malnutrition. This war really has just dragged on. Neither side seems to be able to get a upper hand that would lead it close to victory. And in the process, the poorest people in the Arab world, the Yemenis, are suffering a horrific.
Has the Trump administration had anything whatsoever to say about this? Did it come up last week when the president met with Mohammed bin Salman?
The Trump administration is not particularly good at giving readouts on meetings so far. So we are more reliant upon what the Saudis have said about this meeting than anything else. And in the Saudi version, Saudi Arabia got full and unqualified support from the United States for continuing the war in Yemen. There was no criticism, if you believe the Saudi account, whatsoever from the president or his senior advisors.
So American policy then hasn't changed.
The United States has been a silent partner in this war in Yemen from the beginning. The Obama administration, after the first year, tried to see if a political solution could be created in Yemen, but it didn't try that hard. Looks like the Trump administration isn't going to try at all, and that this war is going to drag on with all the attendant humanitarian implications.
Is there anybody who is in a position to do anything about that? Certainly Iran, as you said, is Saudi Arabia's major opponent in the Middle East, but I can't imagine direct action there, or might there be?
I think the Iranians would like to see this war go on to the last Yemeni, because it costs Iran maybe $10 or $20 million a year to support the Houthis. That's nothing. The Saudis are spending billions on this war, and so are many of their allies like the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait. This is an expensive war for the Saudis and their friends. It's a cheap war for the Iranians.
Very quickly, what about Saudi support for the president's travel ban? Saudi Arabia, of course, is not one of the six Muslim countries included.
Well, I think this is a bit of a source of embarrassment for the Saudis. They don't really want to be associated with an administration that bans Muslims, but they're willing to overlook it now because they want to develop a strong relationship with Trump. I think it raises a question mark, though, in the back of their minds. How competent will this administration really prove to be? They've thrown in their money on the table behind it right now, but I think there's a lingering doubt about whether this administration will prove to be as competent as the Saudis hope it will be.
Okay, and of course, oil politics is always involved when you talk about the Saudis. We really don't have any time left for that. But very briefly, did anything happen in that context when the prince visited last week?
Well, I think the Trump administration understands that Saudi Arabia is the world's number one oil producer, and that makes them an attractive partner.
Bruce Riedel, again, senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, director of the Brookings Intelligence Project. A lot of things covered today, and really appreciate your being with us. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.